You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, this is Phil Rogers, MLB.com Extras, NL Central Edition. And we've still got a race. The Cardinals claimed their what normal spot atop the division, the expected spot leading into September or going into September, but the Pirates now pushing them, and the Brewers coming back as we speak. They've won five of six, gotten themselves back into the wild card picture, and not totally relinquishing a shot at the division. So as we wind down the season, we still have things to resolve in the NL Central. Joined today, as always, by Jen Langosch, excellent Cardinals beat writer. And Jen, let's jump right in with a really good piece that you wrote recently for the Sports on Earth site, Lance Lynn, the Cardinals' secret weapon. I mean, every time I look up, he seems to be running into wins, but somehow avoiding the attention that other guys get. What do you think has made him so big for the Cardinals in his the last few seasons?
Yeah, I mean, you look at this guy, and, you know, it's kind of a shame that I think nationally people don't necessarily know who Lance Lynn is. I mean, he's a guy who his first 2 years in the majors won 33 games, equaled only by Adam Wainwright and Clayton Kershaw, not too bad a company. You know, and this year has really kind of been the underrated ace of the staff. I mean, certainly that ace title goes to Adam Wainwright. He's done nothing to lose that. But if you look at what Lance Lynn has done, his numbers stack up with Wainwright's. And, I think where we've seen a lot of growth from Lance this year is in a couple areas. One, his ability to control his emotions. When we watched him pitch the last 2 years, he's an angry pitcher. He's much like a Chris Carpenter, a John Lackey now that we see on this staff. But, you know, he pitches with a lot of emotion, a lot of anger. And there were times the last 2 years where he just didn't channel that properly. And if things started to get out of control, he would get out of control. And the big inning would happen with him on the mound. This year, we don't see that so much. He's been able to harness it. You'll see him let out his emotions more frequently after an inning is over as opposed to during an inning when things are starting to go wrong. That's been one key for him. The other is just he's found his three fastballs. I mean, this is a guy who has off-speed pitches but really doesn't have to rely on them. And what he's doing is he has a four-seamer, a two-seamer, and a cutter that all move different directions even though the velocity is somewhat similar. And right now he's beating hitters with his best instead of trying to go at them and maybe what their weaknesses are, if it's a weakness to him. So, you know, this is a guy who, again, has emerged as a frontline starter this year. He's only 27, just turned 27. And hopefully the recognition nationally will start to follow pretty soon.
Yeah, that 49-27 career record for a guy who's younger than the Cubs' Jake Arrieta, who's only now emerging, one of the late bloomers. I mean, that is something to hang your hat on. And the fact that, you know, the Cardinals are kind of, seems like they're proving conventional wisdom right, that they're starting pitching depth their overall pitching depth, bullpen included, is just so strong that, you know, no matter the ups and downs you go through a season, they're going to be hanging right in there at the end. That seems to be bearing out a shot at a 90-win season and well-positioned for the playoffs. Looking at the rest of that pitching staff, it seems like they've been able to, because the starters have been doing well lately, been able to maybe rest that bullpen a little bit that had been overworked or worked hard at times this year, and Carlos Martinez a big part of it.
Yeah, you know, Carlos, and I don't think it's a coincidence that Carlos really seemed to come around when Yadi came back behind the plate. The two of them, there's something about that relationship there that they just work exceptionally well together, and Yadi has a way of really navigating Carlos and his emotions through an inning. But, you know, the emergence or reemergence of Carlos Martinez has allowed Mike Matheny to be more liberal in giving rest for Pat Neshek and Trevor Rosenthal. You know, at this point, over the last month or so, you know, Mike has been hesitant to use either Neshek or Rosenthal even on back-to-back days. You know, and we're talking about two guys in the first half of the season that were pitching consistently on back-to-back days, sometimes three straight. And oftentimes four out of five, and, you know, that overwork, I think, caught up to them. So by having another eighth-inning option there in Carlos Martinez, there's a little more flexibility to work around with that bullpen. The hope is that if they can keep Rosenthal and Neshek fresh down the stretch, then you have them, obviously, as weapons into October.
Beginning August 30th, the Cardinals went on a nice 12-4 run. that really positioned them, moved from second place in the Central into a reasonably comfortable division lead, although this time of year nothing until you clinch, I know, seems too comfortable. But looking at that, another thing that has happened is they seem to be coming through in the big spots more often at the plate. The hitters up and down the lineup doing better with runners in scoring position, somewhat back to that 2013 model when everything seemed to click. As you watch it, do you think this is just, is there a randomness to it, or is this better approaches from hitters at the plate?
You know, I think some of it, certainly there probably is a little bit of a randomness, but I think some of it is just some, you know, players that have track records coming around. And, you know, I point to Matt Holliday, first off, and you look at the couple weeks that he's had here, there have been a handful of games where he has taken this team on his back and carried them to a win. And, you know, it shouldn't surprise us that at this time of year Matt Holliday comes around because he's done it for so many years. And I think that's just kind of what this team was looking for with some of these proven, you know, offensively, some of these proven hitters to really find their groove and get healthy and produce at the same time. You know, getting Yadi Molina back in the lineup certainly deepens it. The Cardinals have found a way to finally get some production out of right field by mixing Randall Grichuk, Oscar Tavera, sometimes moving John Jay over there, putting Peter Borges in center. They've really, you know, started to get some production from a spot that, you know, for the first 5 months of the season, no team had worse numbers out of right field offensively than the Cardinals. So it's coming there. Shortstop has obviously been a consistent place of production, and John Jay in center field, another, we talk about underrated guys. Somebody who's having a very, very good season, somewhat, you know, underappreciated probably outside of St. Louis. But, you know, this is a team that, as you mentioned, thrived hitting with runners in scoring position last year. They've started to do that a little bit better. And I think the other key, what we've seen from them over these last couple weeks, is the ability to add on. They didn't do that last night against Milwaukee. It burned them in the end. But over, I would say, you know, if they've left 15, 16 game period, they would score early, but they would score again middle. They'd score again late and kind of put games away. Whereas earlier in the season, we might see one good inning, but then it would go silent from there on out.
Hey, I know Mike Matheny and the guys in the clubhouse don't get the benefit of doing this. And as you put your head down and watch the team every day, it might not be on the front of your view either. But when you look into October, with both these teams positioned to be there, how great would it be to see Clayton Kershaw versus Adam Wainwright two or maybe even three times in a postseason series, given the respect they have for each other and given how they've established themselves as the top two in the National League?
Oh, I pay good money for it, absolutely. You know, and I'm sure over in L.A., Clayton would love a chance to face this team again. When you look back at the 2013 NLCS, and he got beat twice by Michael Wacha, as Wacha was having his special month last year, so I'm sure Clayton would like a go at that again. But, yeah, I mean, when you talk about the elite of the elite right now in baseball, and, you know, particularly in the National League, you start with Clayton Kershaw, and you go right from there to Adam Wainwright. And to see, you know, Wainwright's, obviously we talked about this in the last couple podcasts, but he had a rough month of August. His last two starts have been much more vintage Wainwright. So, you know, the perception is that he is back, that dead arm period is passed, and that he'll be strong to go into October. But, yeah, I mean, when you talk about a marquee pitching matchup, I'm not sure you can get any better than that one.
Yeah, well, we'll hold that one off. We won't draw up our lineup cards just yet, but it's going to be great to see how the best teams in the National League, including the Cardinals, wrap up this season. Thank you very much, Jen. As always, going to be joined by Tom Singer, Pirates beat writer and Pittsburgh native. I always want to throw that in there. Big props to Tom for hanging in with his hometown city and team. Tom, now you're that team, the Pirates. They have had a very nice turnaround since early in September, visit to Wrigley Field. At that point, they had dropped five games behind the Cardinals. They've cut that and perhaps more importantly moved into position for a wild card spot in the playoffs. When you look at this turnaround, what's the most striking thing? It seems to me like maybe just getting more consistent pitching.
More consistent hitting. Your pitching has been doing its share for about a month now. They've gone through a long stretch where it's very rare when they give up more than three in a game. But the hitting went through a spell where they did nothing but hit home runs and not enough of them to win many games. They basically picked it up connecting the dots, like managers like to say, hitting with two outs, bunching hits, clutch hits, hitting with men on base. So I would say, to me, that's been the biggest difference in the last couple of weeks, is they've put together some crooked number of innings by stringing together hits, which they went through a spell where they were not doing that.
Who would you point to that have been really sort of the kind of the keys to September? Nationally, we hear the highlights of the Marte Parte when he hits the home run, and I know Neil Walker stepped up having a big month. Watching it every day, who do you point to, Tom?
The constant factor throughout the season has been Josh Harrison. It may sound trite to keep pointing to Josh, but he keeps coming up with the big plays on defense and getting the key hits. Like you said, Walker's produced some big blows. Russell Martin's on-base percentage is out of this world, especially given his personal history. So he's made a huge difference. So a lot of other players have taken turns sharing in the load, but the one constant really has been Harrison. His season has been absolutely remarkable. He always finds himself in a situation where he can help the team, and most of the time, he comes through. McCutchen actually has gone through a pretty quiet week. He's going to heat up. The one guy that, just gets back to Josh Harrison. I mean, I think, in my opinion, having watched this team all season, he has supplanted McCutchen as the MVP of this team. I don't know about the league, but this team definitely.
Well, one of those big plays in the field that you mentioned was starting a triple play, which was in the last game of a series against the Cubs. The Cubs had won the previous game and taken an early lead in this one. And maybe, I don't know if you could say it was early in the game, they had the Pirates on the ropes, but they certainly were in good position and looked to be having a big inning. Ground ball to Josh Harrison, all of a sudden, triple play. And going back to the notes after the game, the last two times the Pirates had round the horn triple plays like that, 1971 and 1979, pretty big seasons for the Pirates. So, Tom, significant omen or coincidence at this point?
Well, it's a coincidence. Obviously, those are the last two seasons the Pirates were World Series champs. But, that game, once again, summed up the essence of Harrison. He starts that triple play, and Jacob Turner was pretty much keeping the Pirates quite offensively. In the very next inning, his two-run double triggers a six-run inning. So, I mean, those couple innings kind of capture what Harrison is all about. The triple play was, it might seem odd to say, but it's as routine as it comes. First and second, nobody out. A hot smash by Cesar. Two steps from the bag, steps on the bag, throws to Walker, relays to Angel Lambeau, was playing his very first game at first base, by the way. He's part of a triple play. But, yeah, there was a huge emotional lift, and you could sense it right away that it was going to turn around that game, and, of course, hasn't been too long, but the Pirates haven't lost since.
Yeah, I got to think when they put together the highlight film for the season, that play is going to be in the first minute. I would think such an electrifying moment at PNC Park. Look into that pitching that you correctly point out has been rolling for a while now. One guy that really seems to have turned it around, Francisco Liriano and also Garrett Cole, those two guys, are they getting back into that form that they carried into the late September and helping the Pirates make the playoffs last year and then made the Pirates so difficult to knock off? I mean, go five-game series with the Cardinals in the division series and really could have gone either way. Are they back, the Cardinals, or the Pirates rather, back to having that same 1-2 combination in the rotation?
They appear to be. Of course, both of them have had to overcome injuries to get back in the groove, and they do appear to be peaking at the right time. Liriano's overall numbers camouflage the fact that since the All-Star break, he has been money again. Garrett Cole, had a long time out with a lat injury, but since he's come back from that, he's kind of, you know, he's, I started calling him, he's only been around a couple of Septembers, but I've been calling him Mr. September because he was 4-0 down the stretch last season, and he's 2-1 this September, and he does sniff the goal line. He's the kind of guy that, you know, I've been, you know, he's the one guy in that staff that can dominate with stuff, doesn't have to rely on command or maybe defensive support. And literally, I was getting to that point too. The one pitch he's been lacking for the first 4 months of the season is that slider that's almost unhittable. Well, for a left-handed hitter, it is unhittable. And the last time he pitched, we did see the slider that that enabled him to win 16 games last season. So hopefully he can keep that and pitch the big games down the stretch.
Well, I certainly not as significant as those 1-2 starters, but what a lift the Pirates got from Charlie Morton coming off the DL after that sports hernia and 5 scoreless innings against the Red Sox. What can Morton contribute, you know, in the limited time left? And would he figure on a playoff roster to go in as maybe a swing man, or could he still pitch his way into a playoff roster?
Well, I think that's why they gave him the ball Tuesday night. He replaced Vance Worley, who's been pitching pretty reliably, you know, 6-7 innings, 2-3 runs maybe. But they wanted to see if Morton is a viable option for the last 2 weeks of the season and hopefully the postseason. And what he showed them is, you know, he is an option. You're not going to get long starts out of Charlie because he still has that sports hernia. That doesn't go away. And it kind of wears him down after about 5-6 ups and downs. So the 5 innings that they got from him on his return start may be his max. It's a tough call because now you can get away with that because you have a deep bullpen with the September call-ups. Obviously, that's not the situation in the postseason. I think that's what they'll have to decide is whether they can count on more than 5 innings from Morton in the postseason. And if they decide that you know, he's limited to maybe 5 innings, 80 pitches, then they may have to, you know, work around him. You know, that's something you cannot get away with in a postseason situation. You know, the funny thing is, as effectively as he pitched in his return start, he said pretty much that physically he felt the same way he'd been feeling the last month, you know, when he was just working side sessions and simulated games. So he's not making a physical improvement, but he's a competitor, and he'll give you everything he's got while he's in the game. The question is, how long can he stay in games now?
And lastly, we want to say get well soon, Kent Tekulve, who out of the hospital on September 5th with a brand new heart, and hoping he will be in good shape for the end of the season and a possible playoff run with the Pirates. Thanks very much, Tom. We're going to be joined by Adam McKelvey, Brewers beat writer, and we're talking about a team that has shown some resiliency after a horrible 1-13 stretch that seemed to have knocked them from a secure playoff position into uncertainty. They've bounced back as we speak, won 5 of 6 and opened a series against the Cardinals with a hard-fought 12-inning victory. Adam, as you look at this late turnaround, I know there was a players-only meeting late in the bad stretch. Have you seen any differences in just kind of the chemistry, the makeup, the approach of the team?
I don't think so. I'm sort of a believer that team meetings are almost always eyewash. You know, the Brewers got together and they basically just shared some positive thoughts about we're a better team than this. We still have lots of time left. Those types of things. I think the difference and the reason they're winning games again is they're getting pitching. And if you look at that 13-14 that you mentioned, their starting pitching was horrendous. And it put them in a deep hole that then I think bled into problems offensively because they were always playing from behind, and defensively because they were out of games and they got kind of lazy and sloppy. And I think the one of the big turnarounds was a Willie Peralta start, where he just sort of pitched a good game and got them deep into the game where they were in it, and they were able to win. So, you know, I think a lot of times this game comes down to very simple things, and when you try to figure out how to snap out of a losing streak, sometimes a meeting is like the last straw because you don't know what else to do. But to me, it still comes back to performance, and I think you can credit that one pitching performance with being a big turnaround for this club.
Hey, speaking of Willie Peralta, you look at the records up and down the pitching staff, and his, as we speak, 16-win season, I mean, really jumps out at you. I know this guy was a top prospect, but has been somewhat under the radar. Has the season he's had this year kind of should have elevated his profile a little bit?
Yeah, I think it has, because for a lot of those, you know, a month ago we were looking at the major league leader in wins. He was up there with Wainwright and Cueto and some of the best pitchers in baseball, Kershaw, and he was doing things that those guys were doing. Now he's hit a little more of a rough patch along with the team in the last 6 weeks or so. He's not been as dominant as he was, partly because his command has not been as good, particularly the slider command. When that second pitch, you know, he's sort of a two-pitch guy, and when one of them isn't working, he becomes a one-pitch guy, and that's problematic even when you're 96 or 97 with tremendous sink on your ball. So, you know, when he can command both of those pitches, he'll occasionally throw a changeup. He's done that in his last two starts. That's been sort of interesting to see, and that could elevate him further. But he has the raw stuff, and he's kind of a workhorse-type big guy that can go deep in games, that he could be a big-time winner in this league. And I don't think it's surprising that he's made a jump this season. I think what the Brewers would like to see now is, you know, okay, so he's established himself as a winning-type pitcher, the guy who can go deep into games. Now the next graduation would be to a guy who does that every time and just be more consistent with it, more consistently get your team out deep into a ball game. Then he'd be really good, and then he would be considered, you know, their top guy. So there's still room for improvement. This is only his second full season, and this came up with Ron Reneke yesterday that, you know, still at this point you can kind of see as early in the game and decide he's going to be on or not, and that's basically it. Well, last night he rebounded after two runs in the first inning. So perhaps there's little signs that he's, you know, making another step now, and if he does, that would be a very good thing for this team, which, by the way, is going to be relatively, compared to the rest of baseball, flush with starting pitchers next year. And they've got a lot of options. They probably won't have to be one of those teams that goes out into free agency and adds an arm. They probably have their choices already.
Well, one of the guys that has made them that, Mike Fiers, who stepped up and filling in for Matt Garza, 6-1 with a 1.74 ERA and seven starts since he got his chance. Unfortunately, involved in that really ugly incident with Giancarlo Stanton. Clearly, nobody thinks that he was throwing at Stanton and hitting the batter after him. You know, again, I think just showing how shaken up he was. How difficult has it been for Fiers to deal with the aftermath of sending a fellow player to the hospital like that?
Yeah, I think it's been really tough. Number one is his concern for Stanton, which he was extremely clear about in the immediate aftermath of the game, where he was basically in tears from the moment he began talking about the incident. He sent messages to Stanton and Mike Redman, the Marlins manager. He heard back from Stanton. He told us yesterday. And, you know, his big deal is he wants everyone, including Stanton, to know that this was not intentional. And he says he's, you know, him and Giancarlo have exchanged messages to the point where he feels comfortable that Stanton knows this was just a terrible accident. So step two now is kind of getting back on the mound to pitch. And Fiers made clear in a real brief conversation yesterday that he's sort of weary of talking about this. He just wants to move on. And you can understand that this was a traumatic experience, and he's probably gotten a lot of pats on the back, a lot of conversations of support over the last week. And he just now wants to get back to
you know, regular business as usual and not have to think about this all the time anymore. So this is a huge moment in his baseball career. If he takes the mound tonight against the Cardinals and has trouble, I think that leads to some really big questions about when or whether he's going to be able to shake this. But the Brewers say that his bullpen session between starts is really good. As Rick Kranitz, the pitching coach, said, he was throwing to all four quadrants, which is what you look for in those sessions. So his command was there, in other words. Now when a hitter steps in the box, is he going to be able to do the same? That's going to be the question. He has been an incredibly important part of what the Brewers have been able to do in terms of just hanging on. At one point, they had won 12 games total during this last homestand over the previous number of weeks, and Fires accounted for half of those, for six of them. So he's really helped them hang on. He's pitched great, and they need him down the stretch here. So it's a big moment for Mike Fires and for the team when he takes the mound against Adam Wainwright at Busch Stadium.
Yeah, and for a guy like Fires, what I'll say is, you know, you don't have the success he's had at the big leagues without elite-type stuff if you don't have that mental toughness. And, you know, I know these incidents can bother hang with somebody for a while, but I don't think long-term he's going to have any issues getting past it. Great story with the Brewers has been Matt Clark, the first baseman, hitting home runs after being in Japan last year at Double-A earlier this year. But, Adam, when I look at the Brewers, the guy that I see making a difference day in and day out is Gerardo Parra, who was acquired from the Diamondbacks at the trade deadline. And a guy at that time, his OPS had declined, was in decline for the third year in a row. But since he came to the Brewers and basing at Miller Park, as we speak, 305 batting average, 816 OPS, he seems to have really gotten himself in a nice groove and on base consistently. What do you think has helped him make the transition so smoothly?
Well, I think just being a veteran guy helps. You know, he's been around the league. He's been in lots of different roles, you know, everything from an everyday player, a Gold Glover, down to what he's kind of done for the Brewers, which is appearing off the bench. And he's a great insurance policy for this team because they've got right fielder Ryan Braun, who's dealing with injuries all year, including a bad hand injury that still gives them trouble. And they've got a center fielder, Carlos Gomez, who swings so hard he sometimes falls down on home plate. And, I mean, and his all-out style of playing the outfield also puts him at risk for injury. So I think if you look around baseball, you can do a heck of a lot worse for a fourth outfielder than Gerardo Parra. And that's really been his role for this Brewers team. And he'll be arbitration eligible after the season. One of the things the Brewers liked about the deal is they'll at least have the option of bringing him back next year. And he'll cost a little bit. There are financial considerations for this because other Brewers' salaries of their players they've got are going up. But I think there's this possibility he is back for another season in this safety valve type role. And because of the nature of the players they have and just the nature of baseball and the way players get hurt, I'd say there's a strong possibility that he continues to play a lot for this team. So it cost him a little bit in terms of the outfielder, particularly Haniger, they gave up as a good player. But, he's given the Brewers some value there, especially if he's hitting.
Well, thanks very much, Adam. Going to be joined by Mark Sheldon, MLB.com beat writer in Cincinnati, and talking about a team that's kind of finishing out, but certainly a pitcher finishing out an excellent season. Johnny Cueto might be right there in the non-Clayton Kershaw division for the Cy Young Award. Just keeps rolling. And, Mark, when I look at kind of try to analyze what Cueto's done right, you know, this year coming back from the shoulder strains that certainly limited his innings last year, and 2012, the very untimely injury in the playoffs, velocity is the same. I see him using his changeup a little bit more against left-handers and not getting much opponents, not really doing much against his fastball and his changeup. And just kind of wondering, as you've watched him throughout this season, what's stood out with you for the success he's having?
I tell you what, it's just really that he continues to grow as a pitcher. He's getting getting older and older, but when he first came into the league, he seemed like a guy that just lived on his fastball. He thought he could blow it by people, and he had a lot of command issues, and he used to get really flustered when there was adversity on the mound. If had the bases loaded, for instance, he would lose his cool. And what I really noticed is that he can get into jams and get into situations and work his way out, whether he uses his fastball, whether he uses his changeup. One other thing is he's become less of a strikeout pitcher, even though he is racking up strikeouts at a pretty good rate. He doesn't live on a strikeout anymore. He can get the double play. He can spin a ground ball and make guys make mistakes and put the ball into play. And he does that really well. And he just seems like he's just better at all aspects of the game, whether it's, holding runners, whether it's throwing to first base. He's got a great pickoff move. He just seems to have continually each year improve every facet of the game as far as a pitcher goes.
And I'm also wondering, he's under the Reds' control. They have a club option and a good club option, $10 million for the 2015 season. But beyond that, not signed. What do you think what's the organization's position on possibly going out and extending that contract, or will they kind of take a wait-and-see approach, you think?
That's a great question. That's one of the biggest mysteries coming into this offseason, because it's not just Johnny Cueto, who's a year away from free agency. He has a nice club option, like you said, $10 million. But then you got Matt Latos, you got Mike Leake, and you got Alfredo Simon that are all third-year eligible for arbitration. Out of that group of people, I really only see Latos and Cueto as the guys that I could see getting extended long-term. And then it's just a question of which one they're going to be able to do, if they can do, or maybe even both. It'd be tough the way the economics work to do both. But, my guess is Cueto is the guy you want to bet on, just because he's a homegrown, brought up through the system guy. And take away 2013, he's been rather durable for the most part. He's had a couple other injuries earlier in his career. But I kind of feel like he might be the guy they bet on. Latos is also a great pitcher, and this year's kind of a wash because of his injuries. But he's been a 200 inning and got a great power pitch fastball. So it's going to be interesting to see how they do this.
Well, I agree with you, and you look at Cueto. He certainly bounced back from that injury so strong this year that I think that would maybe kind of erase the concern that he would have carried into this year. Mentioning all of the starters, and Homer Bailey, who had the injury problem this year, expectation with the long-term contract, he's going to bounce back from at some point and be a member of that rotation going forward. Could they have the starting pitching depth to maybe move one of those guys this winter to open up some competition among their prospects, Robert Stevenson, Michael Lorenzen, maybe the David Corsino character who's had a September start? What do you think about that? Could they be trading pitching this winter?
If they want to win now, and they keep saying they do, and they don't seem to be in this mode where they want to rebuild at all, I would say it'd be hard for them to move at least Leake, Cueto, or Latos. That's a tough one, because I don't think Stevenson or Lorenzen are ready yet. Stevenson kind of had a tough year in Double A. I would imagine he's not ready for a call up till 2016. Lorenzen's an interesting case, but he's only had about a year plus of professional pitching, and this year was his first year as a starter, and as good as it was, so I'm not sure how much more seasoning they want him to have with the fast track. And then one of the X factors as far as their depth goes is Tony Cingrani, who pretty much was a wash this year. He struggled and was injured, and he didn't pitch at all after June because of a shoulder issue, and he's had durability questions going for him. So theoretically, if Cingrani's healthy and Lorenzen might be ready and Stevenson can take a step up, that answers some of the depth issues. But I don't know if you can count on any of those guys just yet. And if they're looking to have maybe one more run in them to make a go at 2015 and get the band back together and keep everyone healthy, they're going to need all the starting pitching depth they can have.
Hey, when you go 1 through 5 through the starting rotation, Alfredo Simon had the all-star appearance this year, so he certainly got some attention there. It seems to me like Mike Leake is a guy that's somehow kind of always in the shadows, but he just registered his first 200 inning season coming off a strong 2013. For a guy who's still relatively young, given how quickly they brought him to the big leagues, very aggressive with him,
Isn't he something of a kind of a buried treasure type guy that, you know, because he works in a rotation with these other guys that have bigger names, bigger contracts, he sometimes doesn't get noticed, but he's become maybe the most reliable of all of them.
Well, I would say he's more reliable than Cueto, but I would say that he's become kind of a pseudo Bronson Arroyo, who's his mentor. You know, Arroyo is the consummate 200 inning pitcher, durability kind of guy who didn't rely on power stuff, but relied on location and guile. And I think that's kind of where Leek's headed for his career. He's never had power stuff, but when he came into the club direct from Arizona State, he kind of latched onto Arroyo and learned about, you know, his work ethic and learned his way of pitching. And I think he picked up a lot from him. So I would imagine that's the kind of guy he could be. And Arroyo was the kind of dude who never got the gigantic contract, but he got a couple of multi-year deals, made some pretty good money, became an all-star himself, and had a nice career with the Reds and the Red Sox. And I think that could be where Leek kind of fits in that mold, at least. I don't know if he'll ever get the $100 million contract, but I think he will be the kind of guy that either the Reds or other teams would want to have, because who doesn't want a 200-inning guy that stays healthy and they give you 30 starts a year? I think that's something that most teams would want in the middle, the back of their rotation.
Yeah, I think his age would really work for him if they reach a point where they can't keep all these guys together, they got to move somebody. If I was another team, I'd be keeping my eye, especially a National League team, I would be keeping my eye on Mike Leek. And to me, a guy that has been a little bit of the same way for the lineup, just did something very nice for himself. Todd Frazier became the third baseman in the Reds' long history to have a 2020 season, joining the great Chris Sabo and Aaron Boone in registering that accomplishment. And, you know, has he kind of quietly become the most dependable? There I am throwing that out again. But guy in this Reds lineup, he seems like, again, a guy that was kind of has come out of the shadows to really have tremendous value.
Yeah, I think him and Devin Mesoraco are the two guys that have become the dependable hitters, of especially of the next generation of Reds, behind the Vados and the Jay Bruces and the Brandon Phillips. But, yeah, Todd's had a great year. You know, he had a much better first half than he did a second half, but that could be said for most of the Reds. And, you know, what he's done really well is he can hit in pretty much any spot in the lineup so far that they put him in. He's, he's got a nice, not a nice swing perhaps, but it's got a swing that works for him. It's kind of an odd thing. He can swing one-handed. He can swing with zero hands. He obviously hit a home run once where he just threw the bat at the ball. He can do a lot of things, and defensively he's become really a solid third baseman, something he's really worked hard at the last couple of seasons. He's definitely become very dependable, like you said. They really needed more of him, of guys like him and Mesoraco this season, to kind of carry the offense. It was missing a lot this year, and he's one of the bright spots.
And just to close out, I mean, when you look at the Reds' areas of improvement, we did just see them not that long ago trade Jonathan Broxton, get out from under the contract, really moving him to Milwaukee. But I can't help but be struck by this number. As we're speaking, in the second half of the season, the Reds bullpen 0-15 with a 4.68 ERA. I know there are some financial limitations and you can't go out and do everything, but do you see them being aggressive in trying to import guys to get leads to Aroldis Chapman, or do they feel like the Reds feel like they have the arms in their system to step up and correct that?
Well, I think they have a more pressing need to find an offensive guy, maybe left field. But bullpen is definitely something they have to address, especially the front end. I mean, you take away Chapman and Broxton, obviously, this season, the rest of the bullpen really had a rough year. J.J. Hoover had a terrible year. Logan Andrusic had a terrible year. Sam LaCure started off pretty strong, but I think, he hasn't had his best year. Manny Parra was used a lot, and I think that kind of led to some of his issues, and he got injured. But, Sean Marshall is a huge contract they're going to be carrying in next year for the kind of role he has. It's $6.5 million. He's had shoulder problems pretty much the last 2 years. So I don't know how much they can really spend to get front-end bullpen help. And I think if you look at some of the smaller market teams around the league, they don't spend a lot of money on bullpen guys. They kind of give them a chance and see what they can do. And if they don't work, they turn them loose. I mean, I think you got in the system, you know, Jumbo Diaz has been very impressive, 30-year-old rookie. They called up after 12 years in the minor leagues. He's done a pretty good job. He could be a late-inning guy. They're giving a shot to this Pedro Villarreal, who's off the 40-man roster and brought back as a reliever and seems to be having some good moments. It's just they're going to have to look for some inexpensive ways to shore up that area because what they have now is just not working. There's no way they could bridge the gap right now between 6 and 7 innings from a starter to that 9th inning of Chapman. There's a void in about 2 or 3 innings.
Well, thanks very much, Mark.
I'll be joined by Kerry Muscat, excellent Cubs beat writer. And Kerry was at Wrigley Field last night for the 3rd Jake Arrieta no-hitter flirtation this year. And so we'll just jump right in on that. Kerry, did you think he was going to get it? As he's gotten closer, have you started to think this guy's going to finish one of these?
Last night I thought was the best opportunity for him only because he was able to keep his pitch count so low and was really efficient through the start of the game. Plus, it was a perfect night to pitch. I mean, temps were in the 60s. It was barely any wind. The Reds are scuffling, so it was sort of a perfect storm right there. But it was just efficient. It was fun to watch, and if Matt Caesar was just a little taller, he might have gotten that ball. But in the 8th inning that Brandon Phillips hit, but otherwise it was a really, really fun game to watch.
Yeah, I'm going to throw some numbers at you now. Jake Arrieta, you look at him, and he's a guy that really hasn't had a 200 inning season yet as a big leaguer. Certainly looks capable of it. Kind of emerging at age 28. But since the Cubs acquired him from Baltimore last year, now he's made 33 starts, which is pretty much the equivalent of a full big league season. And in those starts, 13-7 with a 2.91 ERA. I mean, crazy. Obviously, the Orioles don't let him get away if they see that kind of potential in him. What do you think has been the biggest factor in him turning his career around? I mean, he's almost turned it on a dime after that trade.
I think a lot of it, and this probably isn't something that's going to show up in the stats or any of the numbers, but a lot of it is just Jake kind of growing up, and he'll be the first one to tell you. He's matured. He's able to handle difficult situations and games better mentally. He doesn't get rattled like he used to, and he's brought that up several times after starts that, you know, if there was something that happened in the game where, I don't know if it was an error or maybe he gave up a hit on a bad pitch like Phillips on against the Reds on Tuesday. You know, if he gives up, makes a mistake, he wasn't able to recover mentally. Now he seems just to be a much smarter pitcher, much more mature pitcher, and he's able to handle that. And those kind of things you're not going to see on a stat sheet or any kind of chart or anything. You're just going to see in the guy's production on the field. And I think the Cubs handled him very well this spring. He showed up with a tight shoulder. He was ticked off from the start because he wanted to pitch. And they explained to him, look, we need you, you know, for the long haul here, and this will be better for you. And they took care of him, and they I don't want to say babied him, but they eased him back into it, and he's shown that it was worthwhile.
Well, it seems like there's been, in the recent past, plenty of other Cubs stepping up and doing big things. But one little thing, it struck me from the Arrieta near no-hitter against the Reds, was Javi Baez making as acrobatic of a tag as I can remember to get Billy Hamilton out at second base in a call that was correctly appealed and overturned by Rick Renteria. Kerry, just Baez at shortstop, he seems like he has, it looks very comfortable there. I mean, he looks like a guy that has played shortstop his whole life, but do you think could he be playing his way into some of the shortstop discussion as well as just a spot in the lineup going forward?
Well, he has been fun to watch, and he is very acrobatic, but the Cubs have repeatedly said over and over that Starlin Castro is their shortstop. So Castro has a big contract. Castro's the one they committed to, a seven-year deal, you know, through 2019. So if they can get Javi's bat in the lineup and get him to be productive, they'll put him at second base. I like watching Javi at short because he's just really entertaining. There's some stuff he needs to work on. He needs to be a little more polished. And the nice thing is, you know, on the road, the last road trip, you know, he'll be out there with Gary Jones, the infield coach, working on some drills. So they're not, even though it's September, they're still trying to polish some things and giving him things to think about and what he should be doing. Should he be in the shortstop conversation? Sure. But the Cubs really are committed. At least that's what they say, is they're committed to Castro.
Okay. One guy we know for sure they are committed to, Anthony Rizzo, came back in a big way, hitting a game-winning home run after missing significant time while taking care of a stiff back. Just how good of a sign was that for the Cubs that, you know, he's able to come back and, you know, really with all that rust, just steps in and seizes the moment like he pretty much has all season. It was his 31st home run, but it feels to me like half of those have either turned around games.
Yeah, it was nice. He hadn't, you know, I've had back problems, so I know that, you know, you can be walking along and everyone will think that you look fine, but you're really in a lot of discomfort. He's been able to deal with it. He's hasn't just been, you know, sitting around. He's been in the cage working on stuff, so he's been keeping sharp. He did admit his first three at-bats before the home run that he hit, the walk-off home run he hit against the Reds. His first three at-bats, he looked pretty bad. Two strikeouts and then just kind of a weak infield single. But he seemed to pick up things in his last at-bat for the walk-off. It's nice to see him back. I know he does work hard on his core. He does do a lot of exercises. And this kind of reinforces how much he has to maintain it. There's going to be no slacking off, and I know Tim Buss, the strength coach, will get on him on this, and they'll set up an off-season plan, and he'll go to work.
Okay, and lastly, leaving the field and going up to the press box, the other night the Mets' Jacob DeGrom struck out the first eight guys to start the game, which tied the National League record, which, lo and behold, was held by Cubs broadcaster Jim Deshays. Kerry, did you realize you were in the company of greatness every day when you pass JD in the hallway?
Every time I am in the vicinity, in his presence, it's a great moment. So, no, JD's one of the best. I hope Cub fans appreciate him. He's got a great, dry sense of humor. I did not know he had the record until I saw the DeGrom story, but and haven't really had a chance to talk to JD about it. But I know we were joking with him last with Arrieta's start when Arrieta struck out the first three that he was going to be challenging the record, but that didn't happen. So,
well,
unfortunately, records are made to be broken, and here we go. So he shares it with somebody.
Yeah, JD did say on the air that records are actually made to be tied, not broken.
Wow,
I think
okay.
He appreciates
okay.
Still having half of that. So Kerry,
I did like that.
For...
I did like that he said that DeGrom was wearing camouflage, which made it a little tougher. For him.
Yeah, those sneaky Mets uniforms. But
correct.
Thank you
yeah.
very much. Thank you very much, Kerry. Thanks for listening. This has been Phil Rogers with the NL Central edition of MLB.com Extras.